My name is Jeff Sutton. I'm a judge on the Sixth Circuit, and I'm honored to moderate this panel about a remarkable book, Scalia Speaks. If you miss Justice Scalia, as I do, the book offers a wonderful way to hear his voice again and to make you smile every few pages or so in thinking about him. It's an even better book for people who don't know that much about the justice, or perhaps for the non-lawyer family members and friends in your life who wonder why you admire him so much. Sure, you can give them a copy of his dissent in Morrison versus Olson, but this book offers a much more accessible way to see the justice in full. So I've seen a lot of people walking around with one copy of the book, but keep in mind, God gave us two arms, not one. We have four ideal panelists to talk about the topic. Let me start with the two co-editors. Chris Scalia is number 8 of 9, the Scalia children. He is a former professor of English who now works at a public relations firm here in DC, CRC Public Relations. To give you a sense of Chris, let me tell you a story that the justice loved to tell about him. So if you remember several years ago at the banquet, the Federal Society quite properly decided to honor Justice Scalia with his 25 years on the bench. And the justice brought Mrs. Scalia, all 9 children from all over the country, lined them up on the stage in order of birth, and said some nice things, including saying some nice things about Mrs. Scalia and her role in raising the 9 children. That part of the presentation ended with something like this: "And my gosh, there's not a single dunderhead in the bunch." Chris, sotto voce, looks to Meg, child number 9. "Dad's always forgetting about me." So Chris inherited his father's wit and writing ability, as you will see from the introduction in the book. Ed Whalen is the president of the Ethics and Public Policy Center. Most of you probably know Ed through his ubiquitous, timely, and often devastatingly acute posts on bench memos affiliated with National Review. Ed and I both clerked for Justice Scalia during OT 1991. We've got a lot to answer for. I've known Ed and known about his talents for a long time. One of the best compliments I ever heard the justice give to one of his former clerks was to Ed when he said, "Ed, you're my knight errant." He's right. Ed deserves that, but I want you to do this again, because before I introduce the other panelists, I do want to recognize their fine work in putting this book together, so congratulations. Rachel Barkow is our third panelist. Rachel is a professor of criminal law and regulatory law at NYU. She just recently became the dean for intellectual life. She's not very happy about that. Since 2013, she has served on the Sentencing Commission. She clerked for the justice in OT 1997, and before that for Judge Silberman. While I have no firsthand knowledge of this, I have often assumed that Rachel deserves some credit for reminding the justice that there are a lot of explicit criminal procedure protections in the Bill of Rights, something all originalists should take seriously. Well, the last shall be first. Judge Amy Coney Barrett. I love that beginning. I know Amy very well, and we are all making her very uncomfortable. She joins the Seventh Circuit, a court with an excellent reputation for many years, and a reputation that's going to be enhanced in the years to come with her on the court. Amy clerked for the justice in OT 1998, and like Rachel, clerked for Judge Silberman before that. Amy has long been a professor at Notre Dame, where she has taught and will continue to teach civil procedure, federal courts, and constitutional law. Amy, we all admire the graceful way in which you handled the confirmation proceeding. Congratulations. So what we're going to do is give each of our panelists a chance to talk about a speech or two that connected with them or resonated with them, and then have a little bit of a conversation. I hope some time for questions at the end. And Amy, we will indeed start with you.
Well, my task, is this on?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, my task was to identify two speeches that I particularly liked. And that was tough, because as you read this book, the justice leaps off of every page. I could hear him in my mind's ear as I read the speeches, the intonation, the pitch, the well-timed pauses. It really is just a wonderful book. But I had to pick two to talk about, so I chose The Legal Profession, which the justice delivered as a commencement address, and The Idea of the Constitution, which he delivered to commemorate the bicentennial of the Constitution. And the reason why I like these is that both emphasize what I think is the central feature of Justice Scalia's philosophy of judging, his commitment to following the law where it went, even if he didn't like where that ended up. He emphasized in The Legal Profession that the task of a judge is what lawyers were good at. And I'll just read you a quote, because it's so him. If you want to know whether deregulation is good or bad, ask an economist. If you want to know whether indeterminate prison sentences are good or bad, ask a criminologist or penologist. What lawyers are good at, what lawyers are for, is implementing these decisions in a manner through a process that is fair and reasonable. Justice Scalia was committed to the idea that his opinions should never be substituted for the rule of law. And when you read the whole book and then you think about this in context, what's particularly remarkable is that Justice Scalia did not lack for opinions. He had a lot of opinions, and they were very strongly held. And so to say this, you know, that one must follow the law where it goes, is made all the remarkable when you think about the man who said it. Because the temptation to follow one's own opinions is only as strong as the opinions themselves. And so that meant that Justice Scalia's philosophy of judging was not only right as a matter of the constitutional structure, but it was also self-disciplined, just given who Justice Scalia was and the size of his intellect and the strength of his opinions and his self-confidence. So he was incredibly self-disciplined, as well as just right and brilliant. The idea of the Constitution, the second speech that I wanted to just highlight briefly, concludes with something that I think made Justice Scalia's legacy have greater impact, and something that I think will make this book continue the great work that Justice Scalia began, and that is Justice Scalia's continual reaching out to non-lawyer audiences, to lay audiences. He points out in The Idea of the Constitution, celebrating our Constitution, that the Constitution cannot be protected just by the Supreme Court, that the Constitution has to be protected. It will only endure if people understand it and cherish it. If people don't know what the Constitution protects, if the people don't understand what its provisions mean, then they will not expect the court to interpret those provisions according to their meaning and according to their original meaning. They will come to expect that the court will, and indeed want the court, to interpret the Constitution in accordance with what the people think it ought to mean rather than what it does mean. And so Justice Scalia ended that speech celebrating our Constitution with a plea to people to familiarize themselves with the Constitution, to learn it, to love it, to read the Federalist Papers. There's one thing about these speeches, you know, that I think that Ed and Chris have really captured, is not only bringing Scalia the man to a wide audience and to a lay audience, they've also, I think, furthered the justice's hope of sparking love for the Constitution in the form of these speeches.
Thank you. Rachel.
Okay. Well, thank you for having me. I had a hard time picking the two speeches that I wanted to talk about. And so first of all, just a plug for the book. Ed and Chris have done an amazing job. If you miss the justice as much as I do, it's wonderful to read these speeches because it's like he's sitting there right there with you. So you want to laugh, you can find some speeches with some good singers in them. And for me, what I think I've been wanting more than anything recently is just a reminder of what it means to be a decent human being in a position of leadership with character. And there are some speeches that I think that's throughout the entire book, from the frequent mentions of George Washington and what made him such a great man. You see it throughout the speeches, but there's two that I want to highlight that I think bookend each other nicely. So the first is a graduation speech called Platitudes and Wisdom that he delivered at his son Paul's graduation from Langley High School in 1988, giving the graduates a sense of what does it mean, you know, to... He goes through, it's very funny, you know, these platitudes you hear all the time, but then he has some serious messages in there, and he tells them, you know, you're told follow your star, which doesn't mean anything if you're following the wrong one. And he says, he says, it's your responsibility, men and women of the class of 1988, not just to be zealous in the pursuit of your ideals, but to be sure that your ideals are the right ones, not merely in their ends, but in their means. And this theme about having the right ends, thinking about doing the right thing no matter what, is through all of these speeches. And he mentions later in the same speech what makes America great. Again, he talks about that same kind of thing. He says, you know what makes America great is how great our people are. Qualities such as honesty. Americans are, by and large, people you can trust. George Washington and the cherry tree, Abe Lincoln and returning the book through the snowstorm are part of our tradition. Qualities such as constancy, Americans can be counted on. There's a theme throughout the speeches that make it crystal clear what makes a good person, what makes a person of quality and makes a person of character. And the importance of that is, I think, highlighted in the other speech that I was moved by a lot of them, but this one in particular. The justice gave a speech as part of the Days of Remembrance commemorating the Holocaust. And in that speech, he highlights that one thing that people really need to remember, he says, the one message I want to convey today is that you will have missed the most frightening aspect of it all if you do not appreciate that it happened in one of the most educated, most progressive, most cultured countries in the world. And he goes on to point out that the key thing that to avoid something like that, to make sure we protect it, what it takes is decent people, people of character. And he says, that can be achieved only by acknowledging and passing on to our children the existence of absolute, uncompromisable standards of human conduct. And I think these two speeches, and whether it's telling a group of high school students as they're about ready to embark on the world what matters, and something as important as commemorating the Holocaust, it's the themes are there throughout everything the justice says in his speeches, and they were about everything that he did in his life. And the one thing that really moved me as I was thinking about this is I brought my son to meet him about a year before he passed away, and you know, was telling him all the things that I really treasured about the justice. And it was many of the same things that are also in some of the speech. There are some eulogies at the end, which I was so grateful that Ed and Chris included, because I think you get a reflection in what Justice Scalia valued in other people, and you can't help but read them and not see those same traits in him. And I remember mentioning many of those things to my son, and as I was reading this, just reminding myself that however much it may seem that we're divided in very various ways as a country, the thing that should absolutely unite us, and I believe Justice Scalia believed to his core, was this idea of character and decency and honor no matter what.
Thank you, Rachel. Chris, why don't you go next?
Okay, thank you. One of my favorites in here, and one of the most surprising ones, was a speech he delivered at Juilliard School of the Arts in New York City in 2005. I think Ed and I thought we had a pretty good idea of what we were getting into when we started reading through the speeches, but there were a handful of very big surprises. There's a speech at a wild turkey hunting convention. I didn't know he did that.
Twice.
Came back for more. And that's included in here. And then there was this one, which is a little bit different from the wild turkey hunting convention speech. Delivered it at Juilliard to celebrate the school's 100th anniversary. He was invited by the school's president, Joseph Polisi, because Mr. Polisi knew that my dad loved opera and was a fan of the arts, so it was a good fit for that reason. And to his credit, Mr. Polisi invited my dad because he knew my dad would offer opinions that the people at that school and at that event wouldn't otherwise encounter. So he expected my dad to kind of challenge them in a way. Mr. Polisi told me that my father was a little bit reluctant, but was eventually talked into going. And he ended up being part of a panel about the arts in American society, a panel along with Stephen Sondheim, the Broadway composer, who also co-wrote Officer Krupke, which was one of my dad's favorite songs. He used to sing it around the house and included it in a descent, right? Or not the whole song, but a line from the song. He sang it from the bench. It was impressive. I don't think my father knew that Sondheim co-wrote that song, but I wish I had told him in advance. And then Renee Fleming was also on the panel, an opera singer, and the historian David McCulloch. So it was a very interesting group, and my father recognized that he was a little out of place in that group. One of the reasons I love that speech is just because of the context, and the speech itself is fantastic as well. He begins the speech by acknowledging how out of place he seems. "I am happy to be here this afternoon, and to tell you the truth, somewhat surprised to be here this afternoon. Today's program reads like some sort of IQ test. Which of the following is out of place? Diva, author, composer, lawyer." These speeches are full of self-deprecating humor like that, but I love this speech because it's just so marvelously constructed. He begins by making fun of himself, wins the audience over by doing that, but then defends his presence there by arguing that lawyers actually are important to the arts. He says early in the speech, "While lawyers do not sing grand opera, they provide the conditions for those who have that talent to make a living at it." And he explains the importance of contract law in the arts, and specifically for opera. So he wins them over a little bit, gets their respect, but then in the second half of the speech, he discusses the First Amendment, and that's where he challenges them. My father liked to challenge people in his speeches. Even if he agreed with an organization or a group of people about 99.9% of an issue or life in general, he would find that minute point of disagreement and explore that and discuss that and challenge them. And so in this instance, he discusses the limits of the First Amendment. And he says, for example, "The First Amendment says what it says, not what we lovers of the arts would like it to say. And frankly, I find it impossible to stretch the freedom of speech and of the press beyond those symbols, including even symbolic actions, that convey thought as opposed to aesthetic, or for that matter, erotic emotions. This means, I am sorry to say, that in my view, even music, as opposed to lyrics, is not covered. The First Amendment forbids the censoring of operas because their librettos are revolutionary, as the kings of Europe used to do, but it does not forbid censoring them because their music is lousy." So, and then he concludes this paragraph with one of his most famous lines, I think. Somebody even sent him a stamp to this, a rubber stamp to this extent. "But not everything that is stupid is unconstitutional." So he ends by challenging the audience, explaining from an originalist perspective, obviously, what some of the limitations are of the First Amendment are. And then he ends that speech with another one of his favorite, or one of his hobby horses, really, that the Bill of Rights is great, but without the structure guaranteed by the preceding articles, the Bill of Rights is nothing. Well, that's an overstatement, I guess. So he says, "Pursuant to that structure of government and democratic tradition, subjects not covered by the Constitution's words, even subjects on which people have passionately held opposing views, are to be resolved by open debate, rational persuasion, and prudent compromise. That produces a body of laws that may seem dull beside the inspiring provisions of the Bill of Rights, but that provide the conditions essential to the flourishing of the arts. So again, it's the context and it's just the structure of the speech and the personality that comes through that I like so much about that one. And very quickly, another one I really like is one of the tributes that he delivered. And this one was for Emerson Spees, who had been dean of the UVA Law School when my father was there. I like this one in part because it describes my family before I was alive. I didn't realize there had been happiness in my family before 1975. So this speech was a real revelation. But it includes some beautiful writing, as a lot of the eulogies do. I just want to, this is, my brother Gene up here really likes the short story writer Peter Taylor, who was at UVA for a little while. And this struck me just as like a passage from a Peter Taylor story. My father's describing Emerson Spees, my older siblings used to call him Uncle Emerson, his love for growing azaleas and spending time at the cottage, a cottage he had. There, those who are fortunate enough to have experienced it will recall another aspect of Emerson's life, Emerson the azalea grower. I suppose there are more impressive displays of azaleas somewhere, perhaps in the Arboretum in Washington, but I have never enjoyed anything as much as the spring party Emerson used to throw for the faculty, when we would stroll through several acres of resplendent azaleas, gin and tonics in hand, taking only slightly more pleasure in the flowers than we did in Emerson's childlike delight at having produced them. There are beautiful passages in here, and Judge Sutton was suggesting was suggesting that these are in some ways more enjoyable than the opinion. Certainly you won't get a passage like that in his opinions. That's one reason I so enjoyed working on this collection.
Thank you. All right, Ed.
Thank you, Jeff. Well, as someone who so deeply admired the justice and who grieved over his death, it was such a great pleasure for me to work on this project, and often just downright fun. As others have indicated, the justice's voice, you hear with every speech, I see his gestures, I know when he's laughing, and everyone, whether you knew him or not, his voice is so distinctive that will come across to you. Nearly all of the speeches in this book had never been published anywhere before. A handful you can find somewhere online, but you know, 90% of these are entirely new to the public, and this is very much aimed for a general audience. This really is not Justice Scalia narrowly, but Antonin Scalia, the man in full, the man of faith and family and friendship, to continue the alliteration, the man of formation, moral formation, formation in civic education to be good citizens. And most broadly, this is about one man's very coherent, comprehensive view, lived out in his life, of what it means to be an American, what our founding principles are about, how to sustain this American experiment, which he recognized is fragile and not guaranteed to prevail. I'm going to also quote from two of his speeches. One is on games and sports. It begins, I have been asked many, many times, to what do I attribute my well-known athletic prowess? The justice then goes on to give a charming account of the games and sports that he played in his youth in Queens. Things like stoop ball, stick ball, street hockey, and something called ringolivio. It's just this wonderful account of what life was like in that period. I'm going to read one more passage from this. He explains that there were no such things back then as soccer moms for various reasons. First of all, soccer momming is impossible without a car, and only a couple of people in our neighborhood had cars, mainly for show. The third reason there were no soccer moms is because there was no soccer. Americans overwhelmingly preferred baseball, a game in which a lot of players stand around while not much happens, to soccer, a game in which people run back and forth furiously well, not much happens.
I dissent on that. I dissent on that one.
The second speech I'd like to quote a passage from is on the Italian view of the Irish. The book actually begins with a section of speeches on the American people and ethnicity. And you'll see in these speeches that Justice Scalia loved distinctive ethnicities and regionalisms. He appreciated our cultural and ethnic diversity in a way that I think a lot of multiculturalists today really don't. He loved the differences, savored them, and yes, sometimes poked gentle fun at them. So for the passage I'm going to read, you need to have in mind that Justice Scalia's bride of 55 plus years was born Maureen McCarthy. The first appealing quality about the Irish, as seen by us subtle Italians, is their bluntness. There is very little beating about the bush with them. You always know where you stand. My wife Maureen has this endearing quality to a preeminent degree. An example that occurs to me is not really Maureen's own line, but a cartoon obviously inspired by an Irishman, which he left on the breakfast table shortly after I'd been confirmed to the Supreme Court. It shows a stern-looking paunchy fellow sitting at the breakfast table across from his wife, reading the paper, and Maureen, or I mean the wife in the cartoon, is saying, while you are a conservative jurist who believes in judicial restraint, you are also a louse. He goes on to celebrate many other qualities of the Irish in that speech. There's so much more I could talk about here. The speeches on faith, I think, really go to the so much the core of what Justice Scalia was. At the same time, there's an important speech on faith and judging that emphasizes the sharp divide that he drew between his faith and his role as a judge. A very important speech that I think, gathering from recent events, lots of folks, at least on the other side of the ideological aisle, don't seem to understand very well. But with that, happy to pass it back to you, Jeff.
All right, thank you, Ed. Well, federal judges moderate these panels. They're not supposed to carry much water, but I can't resist commenting about two of the speeches. I think I'm the oldest one on the panel, so I focused on the eulogies. as Rachel pointed out, they're a wonderful way to get an insight into people because the eulogizer usually eventually becomes the eulogizee when it comes to the values they choose to focus on. So let me start with one. This was a fellow I've never heard of, Morris Liebman, I think goes by Maury. And in the wind-up to the key part of the eulogy, he begins by saying, I frankly don't know how smart Maury was. Now that comment might explain why there are only five eulogies in the book. didn't get invited too often.
Seven.
But then he says, now, I don't consider that speaking ill of the dead, because I have never thought that smarts counted for that much, coming from Justice Scalia. My father used to tell me that brains are like muscles. They can be hired by the hour. It is character and judgment that are not for sale. That explains why George Washington was his favorite founding father. So the other one is about another theme in the eulogies when it comes to the judges, separation of law from personal belief. This is about a judge, Richard Casey, from the Southern District of New York. I, too, was not aware of him. And he's deciding a partial birth abortion case after the Supreme Court's first partial birth abortion ruling. So in his opinion, he did a bunch of fact-finding, had some discovery, evidence was submitted, and he made this finding of fact, that the procedure, quote, is as gruesome, a brutal, barbaric, and uncivilized a medical procedure as there is, but then proceeded to uphold it. Justice Scalia then says, he then compliments the judge's unbending fidelity to the judicial oath, and here's the key point, I can bestow no higher professional praise on a man whose religious values were such a pivotal part of his extraordinary life than to commend his humble recognition that there is a line between law and personal belief. So that was Justice Scalia. So let's go back to our panelists. Christopher, you're a writer. The justice is a writer. What are your thoughts about his passion for writing?
He was passionate about writing.
Okay, Amy.
There's a great speech in here called Writing Well that he delivered to an organization called Scribes, which is a legal an organization of lawyers dedicated to improving the quality of legal writing. They gave him the Lifetime Achievement Award. And he began that acceptance speech by complaining about the name of the award, by the way. He said, you've got to change the name of this thing. But he in that speech, he described the time and sweat that was necessary to write well. I asked him once when I was trying to write well myself whether writing came easy to him. And he said, no, it's hard as hell. And obviously that was a great relief to me. And you know, I should have known that because I saw him working on it. Anybody who lived in that house, and obviously anybody who worked with him, would see him not just reading the briefs, but writing drafts and typing drafts and staring at the glowing monitor late at night and on weekends. He liked to tell a story of a professor he had at his freshman year at Georgetown, Professor Orr, who was a difficult professor. He assigned an essay every week, and every week my dad worked hard on it, and every week the essay came back with a relatively low grade, I mean, by a nerd standard. And my dad, it just inspired my dad to work hard, and he never forgot that professor. I mean, up until years before he died, he was telling me that story. As a writer, when I try to write myself, I just remember the hard work he put into it. And you know, he liked to use the old line of, I don't like writing, but I like having written. It's a difficult process, but when you do it well, there's a great sense of pride from it. And I think he also tried to teach us that lesson of hard work and the pride you get from it by all the yard work he gave us too. But I would have preferred more writing assignments, actually.
Did he review a lot of your essays, or was it Mrs. Scalia that was in charge of reviewing all the homework?
Neither of them did, really. They weren't very helicoptery in that regard. I remember my dad helping
Nine
me.
Nine Children does that,
yeah,
to you.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. They just gave up. He helped me a little bit with my senior thesis in college. Read a page and found some a couple of instances of poorly chosen words.
So Ed, you and Chris both had the honor, really a privilege that I think everybody in this room would have enjoyed, of going through all these speeches, deciding which ones to publish, which not, to edit them, have these great captions for them. Is there anything about that experience that's worth sharing? I'm particularly curious how many are on the cutting room floor, or perhaps more hopefully might get into another book.
Well, we really had no idea what we would find when we were asked to undertake this project. I thought there might be six speeches that he gave year in, year out, and have a thin volume. And you know, speeches were not well organized, it's fair to say. We had different databases electronically and binders here and there. And the first big project was to sort through them, and it was just wonderful to discover. Only took a day or so to say, wow, there's so much here. This is so fun to read through. Speeches on such a broad range of topics that we simply didn't anticipate. The speeches also rarely identified on their face when and where they were given. So one of the projects that we undertook, and this is reflected in the headnotes, short headnotes that accompany each speech, was to do the detective work and figure out when these speeches were given and to what audience. And that was so much fun to call people up, because next thing you know, they would say, gosh, I remember it like yesterday, and Justice Scalia was so generous, and they would send photos and just have stories to tell. How many speeches were there? That involves a difficult metaphysical question, because sometimes you'd run across three speeches, or these three versions of one speech, or these three speeches. We didn't have time to sort that out. Probably a couple hundred by any measure. But it was just very, very fun to discover this and to learn more about them by calling people up and to just see how he would accept invitations from who knows where. I remember there's one speech, I believe it's under the caption tradition, that was given to a Marine Corps prayer breakfast. And there was very little I could tell about the speech on its face, except he had scribbled the name Captain Danzak up top, I guess, to thank whoever introduced him. So I did a quick Google search and discovered that there's a former naval chaplain, Father Thomas Danzak, who's now in Ohio. I called him up, and he just loved to tell the story about how, he out of the blue invited Justice Scalia to this prayer breakfast at this remote Marine Corps Air Station in Cherry Point, North Carolina, and was amazed when the justice said yes. And again, it was one of the highlights of his, I think, 3 decades in the military.
Wow. So how about another book for either of you? What do you think? Looking for new editors?
I think there's room. I mean, we were shooting for a general audience with this one. I think there's a possibility of a collection that would be more oriented towards lawyers and legal scholars, and perhaps room for another collection about comprised of his speeches about faith.
Uh-huh. Maybe a possibly slender volume on faith, but actually maybe our next book would be Sutton Speaks.
Ah, yes. That will be even shorter. Rachel, go ahead. Did you want to comment on this, or maybe even comment on your own initial remarks?
Well, I can tell you the only speech I helped with was definitely on the cutting room floor. It was like comparing Norwegian and American First Amendment. I looked, you know, when you do the index flip, and it
might be the fifth book. Yeah.
In Norwegian. No, the only thing I want, since now we have a little more time, I did want to read a couple excerpts from the eulogies that just, these were the ones that really, the justice was right in my mind. So this is a woman named Mary Lawton, and this is the quote I wanted to read you of what he says of her, but try to read it without thinking of him. She was never a brooder, never a mope, even her anger, and she could rise to wonderful degrees of anger at the latest stupidity of officials in one or another branch of government, was always an exuberant, hearty, cheerful anger. It was more fun to be in the company of an angry Mary than to be in the company of a satisfied and contented someone else. which I think, and then he's got another, this is for Morris Liebman. He says he was a good man with a kind of deep down, fundamental, instinctive, irreplaceable goodness that provokes the description salt of the earth. And then he qualifies that by pointing out that doesn't mean you didn't hear hate-filled words from Maury. He hated as exuberantly as he loved, but only evil things that deserve the hatred of good men. And then he notes that Maury's basic decency and humanity were the greatest ingredient of his success. Those two particularly stuck me as very.
So that dichotomy, I paused with that. Hate-filled is okay, but mean-spirited not?
Right, which is, I think, an important distinction between the two of them. And then he also said things of framers that are similar to that, the qualities that he pointed out.
Yeah, he lost me on it, though, but you could be mean about things you hate. I just thought it was wordplay. I thought it was just a clever line.
Oh, no, I think that if it's something that's evil, you should hate it.
I know, you could be mean about it, too.
Yeah.
I think he was tricking you.
Yeah, well, he got me.
Hate what deserves to be hated, and don't hate anything else. I think he's right about that.
And then the only other thing I'll say, there's the other thing I like that you all did in the speeches that comes through so well, is there's a few things he repeats, the kind of things that are really core to the justice. So when they come back again and again, you sort of see them. So George Washington makes frequent appearances throughout the speeches as someone that he constantly refers to, a man who could be believed, trusted, counted on, a man who would step down as president because that is what he believed a democratic republic required. And then he has other points where he talks about what makes the founding generation so great and why they got the republic off to such a fine start is that they were constantly emphasizing the importance of character and virtue, not only for the individual, but for the society at large.
Yeah. Amy, did you want to add any more?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that's so striking about the book is the justice's breadth, which, you know, was brought to him by, you know, the 9 children he had at home. He was so widely read in American history, loved music, loved literature. And, you know, as I read the book, you know, when I first heard that Ed and Chris were doing this, I kind of assumed it was going to be primarily pitched to lawyers. But it's hard for me to imagine who wouldn't benefit from reading it because of the breadth. It hits something for everyone. I mean, my high school daughter, I'm going to give my high school daughter one for Christmas because it hits so much. And one thing that I think is so endearing about the justice, and this goes to the George Washington point and to the, you know, the smarts of in the eulogy, is that despite the fact that he himself was brilliant and he inhabited a world of intellectual elites, that wasn't the thing he valued the most. You know, and he said outright of George Washington, you know, he was not the smartest founder, yet he was still the one that the justice most respected. And that just goes to the justice's character and his core.
Well, another way to think about the Washington point is the smartest founders all respected Washington. It also mm-hmm. says something about Washington. Did you guys want to add any closing remarks before we offer time for questions?
Sure. I think you see in this book Justice Scalia's remarkable capacity for friendship, a capacity that I think ultimately was rooted in his Catholic faith. But you see in the foreword by his longtime dear friend Justice Ginsburg, her account of how they became friends, and they had a very special friendship, a friendship that I think shows the justice's ability to appreciate the good qualities in others, even while not abandoning or compromising his beliefs at all. And you likewise see that same tremendous capacity for trans-ideological friendship in some of the eulogies that have been mentioned.
Maybe partly because he loved to argue.
Well, and he loved to argue because he saw argument, honest argument, good faith argument, as a vehicle for pursuing the truth, not scoring points. And he understood that if you actually engage with someone and listen to them, they listen to you, you'll have a better understanding of the points on which you really disagree. Maybe you'll persuade each other on some points, but again, argument is a path to truth. And I think what, in some ways, really times could drive him crazy on the court would be those colleagues who would not argue. I remember when I interviewed for the clerkship, reading lots of opinions where Justice Scalia had written a dissent, I'd read the dissent and say, wow, this sure seems like a killer point. Let me go back and see what the majority had to say in response to this. Time after time, the answer was nothing. They had their five votes, and they had nothing to say. They weren't going to bother trying to answer. This ties into the writing point, too, if I may be brief here. It was wonderful, I'm sure you all had this experience too, to see Justice Scalia at the keyboard. It's as though the muscles in his head were churning as he was trying to figure out how to work his way through a passage, and then there'd be the aha moment when things just sang. And of course he loved to read his opinions out loud. I think he understood the oral component of good writing, and obviously see that in the speeches here too. But there'd be times when it'd come back to us and say, it doesn't write. And what he meant by that, of course, is that the legal intuition he had about what the result in a particular case would be, turns out, when he actually set fingers to keyboard, not to work. And what's striking about that is it shows that that writing for him was a deeply intellectual exercise. Any good writer will know that when you're engaged in argument, you discover that there are complications that you didn't particularly anticipate before you started working your way through. For him, it had to write. There had to be a sound path to the end, where I dare say for some judges or justices, writing is instead a process of covering up the path to a desired conclusion.
All right, that's strong. That's classic, Ed. I love it. I know why the justice loved you, Chris.
just a couple of quick points. Ed was talking about my father's belief that argument could lead to truth, and he liked argument for that reason. I think that's why he delivered speeches as often as he did, and as many speeches as he did. He delivered them across the country and around the world, and he the legal section, obviously, in, as far as his legacy goes, the most significant, and he never gave up making the case for originalism and textualism and other, against legislative history, et cetera, against the living constitution, even though he knew that a lot of people in the audience would already know his basic ideas about it because they would know, they would be familiar with his opinions. But he would want to take the case directly to them, unfiltered, without footnotes, without having to spend a lot of time on the details of a particular case, and instead give a broad outline, a broad historical argument, and you know, wide legal context for it. You know, he saw these speeches as an opportunity to persuade, and the fact that he did it for like 30 years, I think, is one big reason that originalism is where it is now, and perhaps even Federalist society is what it is now. Though I would say my dad would be shaking his head if he knew I were on a panel of the Federalist Society. So, I've been gone 2 years, and this is what happens. And Ed also mentioned his dissents. There is a speech in here about dissents, why dissents are important, and why he enjoyed writing them, and it includes a few passages of dissents that he really liked. So yet another reason to buy several copies of this book.
Absolutely. We have about 10 minutes for questions from the audience. I don't know if anyone wants to put their stack of books down and go to a microphone and ask a question. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay.
So the woman in the back, you got there first, and then is that Charles, I think, second?
Right.
For Ed, since
Brian
you read
Hall.
All
oh, Brian,
the, since you read all the speeches, I realize that there's a period of 30 years in which you start with a fully formed, mature Scalia, but I'm wondering if over that period of time, if you detected any change in attitudes, ideas, moods, any sort of development over the period of time.
Well, I think there is a tremendous consistency in the speeches, and for that reason, we never even thought about organizing them chronologically. I think they're really timeless. The only change that comes to my mind is I think that he became increasingly alarmed in recent years about how the Living Constitution would spread to foreign countries and degrade their own exercises in representative government. There's a speech, Judges as Mullahs, that he gave a lot in the last decade or so of his life in various places around the world that highlights that concern.
Ryan, I'm sorry, I didn't, you're up there, go ahead. Sorry about that.
I hate to budge in front of the great John Birch, but so before I ask my question, one thing everybody should know is not only that the print volume, not only is the print volume a wonderful thing to have, and to have on your shelf and to read, but Chris narrates an unabridged audiobook version of the book. And for those of us who do like to hear and imagine the speeches read in the justice's voice, I think, Chris, you do an excellent job of getting the right meter and the right emphases down.
A lifetime of making fun of my father
right.
paid off. There was a purpose.
And actually, Justice Ginsburg reads her foreword there, and there's also a Kindle version.
Right. One thing that's especially striking about the book is that it's one thing to accept speech invitations from a different group of people interested in having you, from turkey hunters to Irish get-together dinners. It's one thing to accept those invitations. I think it's another thing to craft speeches specifically tailored to the audience. It seems to me a profound act of generosity. And I also had the privilege of working for the justice, and one thing that struck me was that he did this not only with speeches, but he also did it with his letters. Everything from letters to law reviews to people who've sent books to him and want him to give them their thoughts on the book. And he would sometimes write short letters, sometimes write long letters. So I guess my question is, would volume two be Scalia Writes?
Ed?
We have an editor. We have someone's auditioning, I think, for the editing job.
It's actually a very interesting idea. We haven't begun to review the corpus of materials there, but I'm sure there'd be quite a bit.
So the man in the back and then John, just to keep the sequencing.
One of you mentioned earlier that Justice Scalia was the type that would want to talk about the 1% place where he disagreed or want to challenge on that 1%, even if he agreed elsewhere, 99%. And so my question is for all of you or whoever wants to answer it, is of reading through the book, where was the 1%, so to speak, where you were either challenged by something or just very much disagreed with something that he had said in a speech?
Well, the soccer thing is outrageous. And you know, but listen, he would agree with me. No one's perfect. He would agree with me on that. So anyone want to more seriously respond?
I'm going to dodge the question by mentioning another speech that I think exemplifies that habit of challenging audiences. One of the last speeches he delivered was the Thomistic?
The Dominican House of Studies.
Yeah. Thank you. It was celebrating the anniversary of the Dominicans, and he used that occasion to criticize the legal philosophy of Thomas Aquinas, who was one of the greatest Dominicans. And I've encountered a number of people who were at that speech, Ed was at that speech, who were just amazed that that's what he decided to do. He compared.
Let me interject. This wasn't just an anniversary of the Dominican Order. This was the 800th anniversary.
So he compared Thomas Aquinas's jurisprudence or approach to judging to Earl Warren's. I'll give you some idea, and it was. He was good humored about it. It was a funny speech, but it was also a challenging speech. It generated quite a bit of conversation afterwards, I think.
Do you guys want to respond to that? So, John, go ahead.
Yeah, there was an argument kind of towards the end of Justice Scalia's career where the advocate making his first time presentation got about 30 seconds in and Justice Scalia stops him and says, "You're not reading that to us, are you?" And I wondered if Justice Scalia in any of his speeches ever spoke extemporaneously with bullet points or just a couple short notes rather than a script, and if he did or didn't, what that implication has for the kind of writer that he was.
Well, if I can, I think, answer that in two parts. First, Justice Scalia was not a strict textualist when it came to reading his speeches. We know that from the little video evidence we have of some of the speeches where we have the text. And I think he would answer that textualism is something that binds judges. It's not good advice for speech givers. So sure, he would sometimes use the text of his speech more as a guide than as a script. Second, on who knows how many hundreds of occasions he gave his, I think, standard speech on originalism versus a living constitution. And he always insisted when he gave that speech, whether it was to school kids at the Supreme Court or Rotary clubs or whatever, that he have with him the outline. Chris discusses this some in his introduction, but his secretary, who spent one night, I think, trying to discover this where this outline was early in her time on the job, was amazed to learn that this outline that he so insisted on having with him consisted of about a third of a page of notes that looks like something you'd scribble on a napkin on an airplane. But this outline somehow just triggered in him this cascade of thoughts that I'm sure produced wildly different variations from time to time. He often did not use a text, and I'm sure often when he had the text would wander from it.
If I can add to that, he delivered a kind of a stump speech through much of the 90s and early 2000s explaining why the living constitution was inferior to originalism. And I was really eager to find this speech because it included a passage I found hilarious and just a great explanation of the living constitution. He compares the Living Constitution's approach to the Constitution and rights to a commercial from the 80s for Prego tomato sauce, where there's somebody at a stove just heating up some Prego. Her husband approaches the stove and says, "What, you're using this store-bought sauce? Does it have oregano?" And she says to him, "It's in there. Does it have basil? It's in there. What about the pepper? It's in there." And my dad would say, "We've got that kind of a constitution now. You want a right to an abortion? It's in there. You want a right to die? It's in there. Never mind what the text says, it's in there." And unfortunately, it wasn't in there. That passage, he never wrote that passage down. I was disappointed. But don't worry, I transcribed it and it's in the introductions.
You know, John, as an advocate, you know, I don't think he was being inconsistent with the speeches he did read, and I did see him, you know, have a script in front of him. I mean, so first of all, of course, you don't generally get interrupted when you're giving a speech. Of course, Justice Scalia broke that rule from time to time, but he was very dramatic. Remember, he starred in plays in high school. He really, one reason I do agree entirely with Ryan's point about the generosity of him to accept all of these invitations, but I do think he liked getting out of the court. I do think he's extroverted, and I think he enjoyed the stage, and he had something to say, so thank God he did enjoy the stage. So, in the back.
Would anybody be willing to offer excerpts from Scalia, the jokes he told in private?
You guys haven't said anything in a little while.
Well, I will say about an unnamed law clerk after the justice returned from a hiatus at the summer, a law clerk remained after he was there, and he said, "Name of law clerk, forgotten but not gone."
That's actually a great way to end.
If I could just make just a couple quick comments here at the end. I think I'm hoping this book will fill two big gaps. First and most importantly, I'm hopeful that it'll be part of the legacy of this great man, and will convey to generations of Americans, folks have never read his opinions, just who he was. Second, if you have gift buying needs, in the coming holiday season, I encourage you to think about this book. Your brother and sister and parents and kids and friends will be grateful to you.
All right, thank you, Ed. This is the last panel for this year's convention, so the convention is now adjourned. But before we completely adjourn, I want to point out two things. There is a reception if you're going out of the Mayflower, the main entrance, and go down one level, there's a reception there. And last of all, I would like to thank our panelists.
Book signing.
Oh, sorry. Ed is a great marketer. He points out there's also going to be a book signing afterwards as well. So thank you to everyone, and thank you for a great convention, for everyone's attendance.